This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, Elizabeth Warren unloads on one of President Obama's key regulators, sending a warning to a possible Hillary Clinton administration about those who are too close to Wall Street.
Also, Donald Trump has called for his supporters to keep watch over polling stations in November. That's troubling. But just as troubling is the fact that the DOJ won't have anybody keeping watch of our elections this year to make sure everything is on the up and up. Danielle Lang with the Campaign Legal Center joins us to discuss.
And speaking of the DOJ, if they're actually interested in investigating Wells Fargo, the New York Times gave them some interesting info about the scope of the account fabrication scandal. That story and Elizabeth Warren's ongoing struggle with Wall Street hacks in our People's Bulletin.
Does that mean we're going to talk about Stumpf?
We are going to talk about Stumpf.
Hell yes.
And spoiler alert.
He got dunked.
He
got dumped.
He got
more like it.
Dumped. Gotta pronounce that F, dog.
Dumped on Stumpf. But first, before we get to Stumpf, as a result of WikiLeaks releasing thousands of emails from the inbox of Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, we now know for the first time what sort of stuff she told bankers behind closed doors in her very, very well-paid Wall Street speeches. We talked at the end of last week's program about some of those details, about how Clinton said entirely different things behind closed doors to banksters than she said on the campaign trail when she was running against Bernie Sanders during the Democratic primary. For example, she was critical of fracking on the campaign trail, but she boasted about how she spread fracking around the world when she was speaking in front of Wall Street. On the campaign trail, she talked about the humanitarian need to protect Syrian civilians by creating a no-fly zone. But in her paid speeches on Wall Street, she acknowledged that a no-fly zone would actually lead to a lot of civilians being killed. Those are just a few examples of the contradiction shown in the Wall Street speeches from what Clinton said in public during the primary. But now we've learned something else about Clinton's Wall Street speeches, thanks to WikiLeaks' release of Podesta emails. And this is really interesting. And it's pretty telling of the Clinton campaign and how it operates. This was first reported over at The Intercept by journalist Zed Jelani, who flagged an email sent to a top Clinton campaign officials. It was an email sent to Clinton campaign officials from the Clinton campaign speechwriter, a guy named Dan Schwerin. And Schwerin had an interesting idea. This is an email from November 2015, as Clinton was pitched in a primary battle against Bernie Sanders, and as she was being criticized for the Wall Street speeches. Schwerin had an idea on what to do about that. What if, he suggested, we just leak one portion of one of her speeches that was critical of Wall Street as a defense, as something that the Clinton campaign can point to and say, see, I told you I was tough on Wall Street. See, look at this. Look at this, what I said in this speech. And Schwerin knew the perfect excerpt, what we could point to, because he wrote the speeches. Schwerin goes on to admit, in fact, that the only reason he wrote the critical passage in the speech to begin with is so the campaign would have something to show the press if indeed she ever got criticized for her Wall Street speeches. Some interesting foresight. Now, I'm just going to read what Schwerin said in his email because it pretty much just lays it all out. Quote, following up on the conversation this morning about needing more arrows in our quiver on Wall Street, I wanted to float one idea. In October 2014, Hillary Clinton did a paid speech in New York City for Deutsche Bank. I wrote her a long riff about economic fairness and how the financial industry has lost its way, precisely for the purpose of having something we could show people if ever asked what she was saying behind closed doors for 2 years to all those fat cats. His word, fat cats.
Those are his words.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Schwerin goes on to say, it's definitely not as tough or pointed as we would write it now, but it's much more than most people would assume she was saying in paid speeches. Now, that's a pretty telling email. It's Clinton's campaign officials essentially conspiring to deceive voters about the actual substance of Clinton's Wall Street speeches.
I hate Hillary Clinton's campaign so much.
I know.
So damn much.
It's one of the only things we got, though, bro. As Zed Jelani writes in the headline of his report at The Intercept, basically this story shows that, quote, an aide planted anti-bank comments in one paid Clinton speech to throw reporters off the scent. Now, Schwerin continues in his email. Here's what he says, quote, perhaps at some point there will be value in sharing this with a reporter and getting a story written. Upside would be that when people say she's too close to Wall Street and has taken too much money from bankers, we can point to evidence that she wasn't afraid to speak truth to power. Downside would be that we could then be pushed to release transcripts from all her paid speeches, which would be less helpful, although probably not disastrous, he writes. He concludes, in the end, I'm not sure this is worth doing, but wanted to flag it so you know it's out there. Now, this seems pretty conniving, but Clinton officials at least initially liked the idea. They thought Schwerin had a pretty good idea here, especially Brian Fallon, her campaign manager, or I'm sorry, campaign spokesman. You see him on TV pretty often. He wrote in response to Schwerin, and he took his idea to a whole new level. He said, quote, this is what Fallon, Brian Fallon writes, I think we could come up with a vanilla characterization that challenges the idea that she sucked up to these folks in her appearances. Fallon then suggests pitching some journalist to do an exclusive by providing at least the key excerpts from that Deutsche Bank speech, the excerpt that Schwerin suggests. In doing so, Fallon writes, we could have the reporting be sourced to a transcript obtained by a news outlet, so it is not confirmed as us selectively providing one transcript while refusing to share the others. Like, this is an elaborate scheme that the Clinton campaign was spinning in November to put to rest these questions raised by Bernie Sanders about the paid Wall Street speeches. I mean, this is deception. This is using the media for your own ends, which, I mean, it's not surprising. That's what campaigns do. As we've already learned from some of these leaks, MSNBC reporters were more than happy to write stories planted by the Clinton campaign. And there are serious accusations against CNN contributor Donna Brazile, who's now the chair of the DNC, that when she was vice chair and working at CNN, she leaked a debate question to the Hillary Clinton campaign. So a scheme to get journalists to do their bidding isn't very surprising. It's what campaigns do, as I said, and we have evidence of them being successful at it. The thing is, this plan didn't work out. They ended up not leaking this excerpt. Schwerin's great idea didn't end up holding any water. And it didn't work out because that explosive excerpt that Schwerin truly believed would put to rest all of this talk that Clinton cozied up with the banks, well, it wasn't even that explosive or critical at all of the banks. The one thing that Schwerin put in the speech to point to Clinton being critical wasn't actually that critical. It was merely Hillary Clinton quoting Chicago Mercantile Exchange President Terry Duffy, warning that, quote, some Wall Streeters can too easily slip into regarding their work as a kind of money-making game divorced from the concerns of Main Street. And that's it.
That was
the excerpt.
That's it.
It wasn't even her saying those critical words. It was her quoting someone who was quoting some Wall Streeters who said that.
Is there more context to that? Because I feel like it could even be, you know, darker than that. And later on in the speech, he's like, you know, but I don't fully agree with that.
Well, it's part of this whole passage he wrote about Eleanor Roosevelt and all this other stuff. Check out the report over at The Intercept. It has the whole passage, but that's the key part, the key critical of banks part that Schwerin wanted to leak to reporters. A senior advisor to the campaign, Mandy Grunwald, saved the campaign from following through on this idea. She wrote in a follow-up email why this was a bad idea, why we shouldn't be leaking parts of the speech. Here's what she said, quote, I worry about going down this road. First, the remarks below make it sound like HRC, Hillary Clinton, doesn't think the game is rigged, only that she recognized that the public thinks so. They are very angry. She isn't. In other words, as I said, this speech excerpt isn't even her words and doesn't actually convey Clinton being critical of Wall Street. It conveys someone else who's quoting some Wall Streeters. Grunwald goes on to say, quote, second, once you start looking at speeches, you run smack into Maggie Haberman's report for Politico on HRC's Goldman Sachs speech, in which HRC isn't quoted directly, but described as saying people shouldn't be vilifying Wall Street. Maybe you think the Deutsche Bank speech takes the sting out of that Goldman report, but I am concerned that the passage below will exacerbate, not improve, the situation. Apparently, Grunwald's concerns were heard, and the plan was never put into motion.
Well, at least they're a little competent, because that sounds like a terrible plan.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I just kind of found this. You flagged it for me earlier. I found the story astounding. Yeah. I thought it was, you know, just worth sharing. I mean, going back and looking at the primary against Bernie Sanders, how many times did we hear Clinton say that there was nothing damaging in the paid Wall Street speeches? How this wasn't a big deal at all. How her word in public and in private are exactly the same. We heard that a lot.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
And yet, while this was going on, the Clinton campaign was discussing how to remedy the damage being caused by these speeches and conspiring in secret to mislead voters and the press on what she actually told the banks.
I got to say, if you're an activist, obviously of the progressive bent, this story should get you pretty excited. It's not really going to impact the general, I don't think.
No, it's not. I'm about to get to.
Right. But people are going to remember these WikiLeaks for a while here.
Right. They might not be groundbreaking. They're just informative. And I'm sure if we had leaks from the Trump campaign, we get a lot more stuff there, too, about how things are working out. And you know what?
We probably
will when this is all said and done.
God, I hope so.
I'm sure there are tons of people in the Trump campaign just waiting, just ready for this to all be over to spill the beans.
I just got to say, I mean, even for Trump's talk of law and order and authoritarianism, there's got to be a few weak points of cybersecurity in there, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to kind of round this all out here. As I said, stories like these work to reinforce voter concerns about Clinton, you know, that she's a politician, she'll do anything to get elected, and it's stories like these that could harm a campaign. Luckily, though, for Democrats this year, the revelations like these from the Podesta leaks won't go anywhere because Clinton is running against a reported sexual offender, Mr. Donald Trump. Over the weekend, we had more women come forward alleging that the GOP nominee sexually abused or harassed them. I expect we'll have more women coming forward until the election day, more stories, more leaked audio tapes. This is Donald Trump. The situation, by the way, with the Trump campaign, its ongoing implosion, has Democrats actually believing that they can turn this election not just into a victory for Hillary Clinton, but into a wave election, an election in which Democrats take the House and the Senate. I mean, that would have been unbelievable to think of, but Trump's candidacy is actually putting that in reach. But you can leave it to Democrats to squander it. I mean, the Senate, it looked good for a while. I mean, the math is against Republicans in the Senate. They have more seats up for grabs, and the Democrats need to just pick off a few of them to take control of the Senate.
Yeah, and Dem turnout is usually higher in a presidential year as well.
Right, right. The House is a bit more difficult. The House, the game's rigged against Democrats.
The game is so rigged in the House.
The congressional districts have been redrawn since 2010 to favor Republican candidates so that even you've seen in past midterm cycles, Democrats collecting a million more votes than Republican candidates, but not being able to sway the majority in the House.
Well, in presidential in 2012, that was the year they got, I think, a million more votes in congressional races. A million more votes and no House majority.
Right. But in order to take advantage of this election, in order to take advantage of the carnage caused by Trump to down ballot Republicans, you got to actually put up candidates. You got to put up people who can actually win races. And Democrats aren't really doing that. I'm going to read from a Vox report here, and I apologize to our listeners beforehand. You know what they say about a broken clock, though.
Hey, they're, you know.
That was rude.
Come on.
That was rude. Sorry. But I'm just going to read from a Vox report on some of these candidates here.
This is a Jeff Stein report as well. He's pretty good.
Yeah, okay. In New Jersey's 3rd District, Democrats are running someone who has been unemployed for the past 6 years and has a checkered history of failed debt payments. They have a beekeeper with no elected experience taking on a powerful incumbent in California's 10th District.
Wait. Can I pause you there? Bees are going endangered. They're going extinct. I think maybe a beekeeper can bring something valuable to this. Anyway, sorry for the interruption.
Yeah, that's a fair point. The Democratic candidate in eastern Kansas is a commodities trader who only decided to launch his first political campaign a few months ago.
Hell yeah.
The report goes into more detail. Democratic candidate Frederick Laverne, one of New Jersey's third district candidates, spent weeks not talking to the press and had only raised $600 for his campaign as of this summer.
$600. Okay.
His website is also filled with amazingly bizarre rants in Latin and quotes 19th century novelist Gustave Flaubert as saying,
"It's Flaubert."
Sorry, Flaubert. As saying, quote, "You can calculate the worth of a man by the number of his enemies."
That seems like something I would tweet.
Yeah. Virginia's second district could be competitive based on how it went in previous presidential elections, but Jeffrey Skelly, a political analyst at the Center for Politics, notes that Democrats have a nominee whose top experience consists of failed bids for city council. Then there is someone in North Carolina that Democrats have nominated, a little-known county commissioner who has barely raised any money. So, look, all I'm saying is Trump has left the door open this election. He's left the door open for this to be a wave election for Democrats to take the Senate, maybe take the House. The door's open. Unfortunately, Democrats are setting themselves up to walk just right into the dang door frame and break their nose instead. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, where the two Sams are still here with you from Washington, D.C. So we've got like 3 weeks until the election. 3 weeks until I no longer have to hear Sam Knight say, "Ugh, when will this election be over?" And I'm sure 3 weeks until he doesn't have to hear me groan the same exact thing. But when Election Day finally arrives, it will be a little different than prior contests. Not just because Donald Trump is on the ballot, but also because there won't be as many election observers on the beat making sure everything goes well. As we noted on a previous show recently, the Department of Justice is not sending out specially trained poll observers to ensure that people aren't intimidated or turned away from the polls and to make sure that people can actually vote. In the 2012 presidential election, the Justice Department sent more than 780 observers and other personnel to polling places in 51 jurisdictions in 23 states to watch for unlawful activity and to write up reports about possible civil rights violations. Well, Justice Department officials say this year they are sending observers to fewer than 5 states and to only locations because the oversight has been ordered by judges in specific cases. Now, I can't remember an election that has had this much anxiety about the integrity of the vote. Both sides claiming that the election is being rigged by the other. So why is the DOJ removing critical oversight on Election Day? Well, here now to provide some insights into this story and provide sort of a lay of the land of election law heading into November 8th is Danielle Lang. She's the Deputy Director of Voting Rights at the Campaign Legal Center. And you can follow her on Twitter at DannyLang_DC. Hi, Danielle. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the Department of Justice claims they're cutting back on these Election Day observers due to a Supreme Court ruling. What case was that, and what did it determine, and what effect is that going to have?
Sure. So this is actually a case that dates back to 2013, and it's a case called Shelby County v. Holder, which is probably a case name you've heard before.
Right, yeah. And it's to do with the Voting Rights Act, right?
Exactly. And it struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4. And basically what Section 4 did was define what states had a history of discrimination in voting and therefore had to pre-clear any voting changes they wanted to make with the federal government. So if you had a history of discrimination in voting, like, for example, many southern states like Texas, if you wanted to make a change, like implement a voter ID law, you had to have it pre-cleared with the federal government. The federal government checked it to make sure it would not have a harmful effect on minority voting rights. If it wouldn't have a harmful effect, it was allowed to go forward. If it would, it could not.
And this is the way it worked for decades, from 1964,
I guess. From 1965 until 2013.
Okay.
and that changed. And it's obviously had hugely detrimental effects across the board. It's why I've been litigating and my organization has been litigating the Texas voter ID case since 2013, because it was previously blocked by Section 5. The day that Shelby County v. Holder was decided, the Texas Attorney General announced he would be enforcing the voter ID law. That law has been struck down, at least in part, and modified for this election, but it took 3 years of litigation to get there. But I believe an unintended result is the effect on the observer program. So when the Supreme Court decided Shelby County v. Holder, it was very focused on the preclearance formula and the requirement that states preclear all of its voting changes. And it considered that to be a very severe restriction on states, and that's why it struck it down. But the preclearance formula also related to the observer program. It's what gave the Department of Justice authority to go in without permission and observe polling places to make sure everything.
You say without permission, that elections are very local, a lot of local jurisdictions, there's like 5,000 different jurisdictions. So this has always been a sort of localized practice in America.
Exactly. And so this allowed federal observers to go into any of those locations. The Department of Justice has read Shelby County to mean that the preclearance formula is not useful for anything anymore, and it no longer gives them the authority to go into jurisdictions unless they're given permission. That's probably a somewhat conservative reading of their power, and we do believe that there would be a reasonable reading that would allow them to continue using their authority under Section 8 of the Voting Rights Act to send in observers, but they read Shelby County differently, and so they've decided not to use that authority under Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act anymore. That being said, it is important to note that they'll still be doing a federal monitoring program. That monitoring program is based on permission from the states, but my understanding is that many states do give that permission. So there still will be a presence on the ground. It just will be different. And of course, in an election where there's been such heightened anxiety, this is a poor confluence of events and is discouraging. And I think it puts the onus on civil rights organizations to really step up and make sure that they're doing proper election protection as well. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, along with a coalition, does an excellent job of election protection and runs hotlines for individual voters who are having problems, can contact someone immediately to discuss those problems. So it's going to be critical that other election protection programs are working correctly.
So the Justice Department, this is entirely, well, the Supreme Court case, but it's of their reading. They didn't challenge this. They didn't say, we're going to try to send observers and then, you know, you're free to challenge that in court if you think it's illegal under, you know, precedent. I mean, why not? You think it's just a limited resources thing? They didn't think they would win?
I don't think it's limited resources. I mean, you'd have to ask the Department of Justice, but I don't think it's about limited resources. I think they believe that Shelby County's pretty clear on this point. I think they believe that if they struck down Section 4, they struck down Section 4, and anything that's connected to Section 4 is no longer valid.
Sure.
And so I think that they're, you know, basing that on their reading of Shelby County. Like I said, I think there's a way to say that Shelby County was really just talking about Section 4 in connection with the preclearance requirement, and we would have preferred the Department of Justice to adopt that reasoning. But I don't think it's just that they threw up their hands and said
sure.
that they don't want to do it. It's just I think that they feel that their hands are tied.
It was open and shut, in their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Not to go off on too much of a tangent here, but the formula that was struck down by the Supreme Court, in a way, they sort of had a point that it could be worth updating this formula. I mean, there are states that could pass restrictions that aren't necessarily included in this formula, and maybe they should be included. The problem is Congress hasn't gone about to update this formula. I mean, the last time the Voting Rights Act was renewed, including this section, it was a unanimous vote pretty much. But since 2013, since this ruling, Congress hasn't gone back to work to, revisit this formula and then allow the Department of Justice to carry out what they need to.
You're absolutely right, at least on one part. I don't think...
Please prove me wrong. I love when guests prove me wrong, actually.
Well, no, I think you're generally right. I don't think the Supreme Court had a point in striking down the formula because the evidence was overwhelming that at least those states included in the formula had a history of discrimination and one that was ongoing. So the evidence for including the states that were covered was very strong. That being said, of course, I think some other states maybe could have been added given their current history. For example, Ohio was not a covered state, but Ohio does have a current history of voting restrictions that are very concerning. So in that way, I think they had a point. But your overall point is very well taken, which is that the Supreme Court was very clear that it was basically handing off the ball to Congress to update this. They said that voting race discrimination in voting is not over. They recognize that it's still ongoing. And so they handed the torch to Congress to pass a new formula. Laws have been introduced in Congress to update the formula, and they've gone nowhere. And in fact, representatives in the House refused to even hold a hearing, saying that there's no point because there's no evidence of voting discrimination, which in this election is really hard to believe.
And again, these are lawmakers who just a few years ago supported this provision for the most part.
Sure. But just to go back a little on that Supreme Court case, correct me if I'm wrong, though, but in the oral arguments, one Antonin Scalia said that the Voting Rights Act constituted, quote, racial entitlements that needed to be sort of stricken, repealed. Did he not? He did say that, right?
Yeah, well, luckily he's dead.
that's sorry. What I was getting to. Sorry. Anyway, don't mean to put you in an awkward spot.
Can some of these oversight gaps be filled by other entities outside the Department of Justice? And I know this is walking a bit of a thin line since we've heard Donald Trump call on his supporters to go out and monitor polling stations to make sure everything is on the up and up, when really what he seems to mean is go and intimidate voters at polling stations. But is there are there a way organizations or citizens can play this role of monitoring without also being a force that, you know, threatens voters at the polls?
Of course there is. There are a number of nonpartisan election protection organizations. Like I said, there's a great coalition led by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights that does nonpartisan election protection. Their goal is just to make sure everyone gets a chance to vote and that the laws are followed, nothing else, right? They're not on a witch hunt for voter fraud. They are just concerned about making sure that people have access to the right to vote. And certainly citizens can play that important role. It's really important to have educated poll workers. I think this is an understated way that citizens can participate. Poll workers are desperately needed. They are our gatekeepers. And so I encourage everyone, if they can't do it this election, to think about doing it for next election. Go be a trained poll worker and take that responsibility really seriously. And of course, you know, there's nothing wrong with partisan election protection if it's done in a way that is meant solely to truly watch, which is what election protection is supposed to be. Watch and make sure there are not problems and voters are able to vote. That's different than taking law into your own hands and deciding when you think that there is fraud or that someone isn't eligible to vote. And I think that is at least what Donald Trump has been asking for implicitly. Yeah. And it's very concerning, especially when it's directed specifically at, quote unquote, certain areas of Philadelphia, which is not a subtle dog whistle at all to the intimidation of Black voters. And we're very concerned about it. And I think that he needs to be very careful that he's not inciting his supporters to maybe inadvertently commit a crime.
Well, that's my next question here is, I want to read what Trump, his quote exactly, and people can, you know, hear the dog whistle when he says it. You've got to get everyone of your friends, you got to get everyone of your family, you got to get everybody to go out and watch and go out and vote. And when I say watch, you know what I'm talking about, right? You know what I'm talking about. I think you got to go out and you got to watch. Is Trump pushing illegal behavior here if he's calling? I mean, what are the rules when it comes to intimidation and stuff at the polls and what Trump might be suggesting?
So I think that people feel pretty confident that they do know what he's talking about. And that's what's most concerning, right? And most chilling is that they know exactly what he's talking about. And these tactics really aren't new either. I mean, it's maybe new for a politician, especially a presidential candidate, to be so explicit about what they're calling for. But ballot security groups, quote unquote, ballot security groups that go and try to intimidate voters are not new. The Republican Party is actually under a consent decree not to engage in this kind of activity because it has had an intimidating effect in the past. And so they're not allowed to engage in this, quote unquote, ballot security efforts at the polls. They have to keep it to true watching, not ballot security, as they like to call it. And And it is, it borders on criminal behavior. Section 11 of the Voting Rights Act criminalizes voter intimidation. So if you're in, if you are engaging in what can be objectively considered intimidation of minority voters or intimidation of voters that you believe to be of the opposite party, you are you're walking a very fine line. And I think maybe even Trump supporters might not be aware of this. You know, they've been convinced that it's kind of their responsibility as citizens to go and kind of question every voter. That is not the role of individual citizens.
I guess we could just chalk this up to one of the numerous campaign violations that the Trump campaign has put forward.
Yeah, I mean, and to tie it into another dog whistle, Trump has been repeating that what establishment Republicans have been bleeding about for years, which is that there's mass systemic voter impersonation and voter fraud going on. And he's brought that up in a lot of his speeches, saying everything's rigged. And of course, as we saw with as we saw with North Carolina, when that got shut down by an appellate court ruling, their voter ID law was found to have surgically targeted African-Americans. And those were the words of the appellate circuit and not my own.
Yeah. Speaking of voter ID laws, 14 states have new voter restriction laws taking place for the first time during this presidential election this year. These are exactly the sort of reasons why observers would be important to ensure that these new laws are interpreted correctly and nobody is denied their right to vote. Can you just kind of give us a broad overview of what kind of new restrictions are going to be taking effect this year that could be worrisome?
Sure. So I'd like to point out, we did have a pretty amazing summer and fall for the voting rights community. And I think for democracy, that a number of these laws were struck down, not only North Carolina, but the Texas voter ID law, the Kansas requirement that you provide certain forms of documentary proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, even though there was no evidence that that was necessary and that there was no evidence of non-citizen voting going on. The Ohio purge of voters who hadn't voted recently, those voters have been ordered back onto the rolls. Georgia voter registration has been updated to make sure that people get on the rolls properly. And so those are big victories. But that being said, there are new voting restrictions that will be in force on Election Day. A number of photo ID laws in particular, while some have been struck down, including North Carolina and Texas, you still have Mississippi, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, all of their voter ID laws are still fully in effect. And of course, the devil's in the details that we need to make sure that these are being properly followed. For example, South Carolina has a reasonable impediment declaration. If you do not have an ID and you cannot reasonably obtain one, you need to be allowed to vote with an alternative form of ID. We need to make sure that that's actually enforced and that poll workers understand when they should be offering this to voters so that access is easily available for all citizens. So those are the types of things we're seeing. I think that there is some confusion that advocates are working really hard to clear up before Election Day. The Wisconsin litigation about the voter ID is still going on, and mm-hmm. it's still a little bit unclear what the requirements are going to be on Election Day. Wisconsin is being ordered to do better voter education around the free ID that you can get easily at the DMVs. So we're continuing to do education on that front. Similarly, I believe litigators in Ohio are still fighting to make sure that purged voters are put on and that in Texas, the new procedure for voter ID is properly implemented.
Well, we'll see how all of this goes down in about 3 weeks now. Danielle Lang, Deputy Director of Voting Rights at the Campaign Legal Center. Follow her on Twitter at Danny Lang. That's with an I_DC. Thanks so much for coming on. That was extremely informative. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
More Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I am still Sam Knight.
We're still the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. And we continue on with the show now with some economic news for the 99%.
Elizabeth Warren is on the warpath again, calling on the White House to fire a key regulator.
Whoa, warpath?
Ugh.
Warpath? Are you picking up on Trump's attacks on Elizabeth Warren's Native American heritage?
That is not at all what I'm doing here.
Continue, please. Continue.
I will. Mind my P's and Q's here. On Friday, the senator wrote a letter to President Obama asking him to take the extraordinary move late into his second term of firing Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Mary Jo White.
See ya.
Warren's letter was 12 pages long and chock full of ways the SEC has disappointed her. It almost entirely centered on White's very evident distaste for transparency.
I would hate to have Elizabeth Warren disappointed in me. I'm just saying that right now.
Well, let me stop there for a second, because I'd like to say, if Elizabeth Warren was disappointed in you, there would be a good chance that you'd be also making millions of dollars.
So that's true.
At least you would have that to keep you warm at night.
Yes, true.
Anyway, reading now from the letter that Warren wrote, she, obviously referring to White, has failed to complete disclosure mandates Congress enacted in the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown, while simultaneously devoting the SEC's limited discretionary resources to a far-reaching anti-disclosure initiative cooked up by big business lobbyists. Now, Warren has repeatedly bemoaned this initiative, what White calls, quote, information overload. It is a matter Warren has long alleged that has been completely fabricated. Investors simply don't believe there's too much information disclosed by publicly traded companies to the SEC, is what she said Friday, as she has said numerous times before. But reading now from the letter, one prominent group does believe that information overload is a thing, that is, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the biggest lobbying group in the country, which lobbies government on behalf of the giant companies, reading now from the letter again, responsible for making these disclosures. Despite the lack of data to support this effort, Chair White plowed ahead with it. That's pretty harsh words there. That's grounds for dismissal in my book. If you are a major manager of a huge thing, pushing forward with a huge initiative,
yeah,
there's just no evidence that it needs to be done.
Yeah.
In her remonstrance, the senator also brought up the fact that White has made no move to support a political spending disclosure rule, one called for by every member of the Democratic Senate caucus. Shout out to independents Angus King and Bernie Sanders, who caucus with Dems, but technically aren't Dems.
What up? We hear you.
What up, King and Bernie? Bernie King. Anyway, the rule would force companies that publicly trade stock to tell investors how their own money, investors' own money, is being spent to peddle influence. Warren also noted that the SEC could have moved to plan for a rule despite Republican policy riders on budget bills that prevented the commission from temporarily finalizing, issuing, or implementing any such rule on political spending disclosure. The SEC didn't push back on this. It didn't even try. Again, this is in contradiction to basically every Democrat from the establishment to the rank and file Democrat appointee, Mary Jo White.
And according to two Sams and one Warren, a fireable offense.
Yeah. But it gets worse, though. According to Warren, not only is White pushing a lobbyist back initiative that would muddy the waters more, the quote unquote information overload crusade, and not only is White out of touch with the entire Democratic Party, she's not doing her job to make rules she has been ordered to make by Dodd-Frank. As of October 2016, Warren wrote, the SEC has yet to finalize 19 mandatory rules under the financial reform bill passed more than 6 years ago. These include a rule to enhance the reporting and dissemination requirements of security-based swap information, Warren wrote. Those are derivatives. A rule to require registrants to disclose pay versus performance information. Seems like a very crucial rule if you want to do clawbacks, you know, if you see that executives are getting overpaid. And
for running their company into the ground,
right.
Essentially.
And this was a problem in 2008. We saw short-term compensation packages that didn't account for long-term ups, pardon my French. Anyway, and also the SEC is not moving yet a rule to increase the transparency of information available with respect to loan or borrowing of securities. Moreover, Warren also noted in building this very thorough case that White errs dangerously on the side of industry when it comes to transparency. She, White, has remained conspicuously silent when your administration has issued veto threats against anti-disclosure bills. Enough is enough, Warren thundered. I respectfully urge you to exercise your unilateral authority to immediately designate another SEC commissioner as chair of the agency.
It seems like a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing for a Republican to call for a Democrat to fire one of his appointees.
Right.
Here's Warren calling on her own party's president to do it.
Enumerating all the ways she's disappointed, White has disappointed her own party, her own entire party. And she hasn't gone to bat at all for Democrats. And, you know, going through and observing sometimes these House committees, financial services, et cetera, and they do try to pass a lot of these anti-disclosure bills. I mean, that was getting me mad when I was reading that. And it's like, yeah, you know, Mary Jo White, she hasn't been very vocal on those.
Yeah, you know who should be paying close attention to this dust up? Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's right.
She's going to have to deal with Elizabeth Warren if she wants to appoint people too close to Wall Street.
Exactly. Well, I was just going to say, it seems highly unlikely that this is really directed at Obama. Like, it doesn't seem likely he's going to expend the effort to dismiss Mary Jo White.
Yeah, it's
this
a shot across the bow here.
Exactly. It's a clear signal to Hillary's folk. Warren will not sit on her hands and be a good team player. If Clinton nominates Wall Street hacks to key administration positions, you know, there's a tradition in the Senate of keeping one's head down as a noob, a freshman, fresh woman, by the way, freshman, technically a sexist term, fodder for another show, perhaps. Anyway, Warren voted for White's confirmation in 2013. And in her letter, she wrote a letter last year telling White how disappointed she was in her entire tenure. And she referenced that vote and she was like, yeah, maybe confirming you was a mistake. So now that she has a little more seniority, I don't know. I think Warren's going to go ham on some Clinton nominees.
It's assuming Clinton doesn't try to neutralize her and bring her into her administration.
Yeah, well, also assuming that
Warren would do it, too.
That Donald Trump doesn't win.
In which case, Elizabeth Warren will also be very busy.
Yeah, well, anyway, if assuming, as is easily assumable, that Clinton wins, if Elizabeth Warren doesn't, like, hold her nominees to this high standard that she indicates as she will with this White letter, I am going to be one disappointed fellow.
As will I, but I'm confident she will.
Anyway, moving on to telecoms issues, is Comcast about to be the FCC's next Tinder date? Because the commission thinks that Comcast is looking fine-able. The regulatory body penalized the phone, cable, and internet giant $2.3 million for its billing practices. It is the largest ever civil penalty imposed on a cable provider, according to NPR. The conglomerate was dinged by the FCC after a two-year investigation into its policies. The probe found that thousands of Comcast customers were ordered to pay for items they had specifically declined after sales pitches from Comcast agents.
FCC, real thirsty. Just like you. Thirsty to fine, though. Thirsty to fine.
Nice. In a statement, FCC Enforcement Bureau Chief Travis LeBlanc said, it is basic that a cable bill should include charges only for services and equipment ordered by the customers, nothing more and nothing less. We expect all cable and phone companies to take responsibility for the accuracy of their bills and to ensure their customers have authorized any charges, he added. The illegal practice, by the way, has a name. It's known as negative option billing. Some little editorializing here. This seems kind of similar to the Wells Fargo scandal when the bank was caught opening up over 2 million fake accounts and fired thousands of employees for the systemic practice, 5,300 employees to be exact. This fraud involving Comcast probed thousands of the complaints over essentially the same thing, unauthorized sales of products, yet one is fined $185 million and one is fined $2.3 million. I don't know, maybe I'm just the layman here. Maybe I think Congress should pass legislation to close this discrepancy. Fraud is fraud, or unauthorized accounts are unauthorized accounts. Excuse me, Wells Fargo lawyer team.
Yeah, they're already preparing their correction email to you.
I've already issued the correction. Anyway, but if Congress did act on this account unauthorization issue, which seems like an increasing thing or an increasing awareness of this, I would suspect that Congress would probably end up making account fabrication perfectly legal somehow, possibly by accident, possibly by a few lines of legislation shoved in there by some staffer. I don't know.
Yes, would not surprise me.
And speaking of Wells Fargo, we should probably catch up on that story and rattle off some delicious headlines. First of all, Stumpf has been dumped.
Dumped.
Embattled CEO John Stumpf resigned from Wells Fargo on Wednesday in the wake of the account scandal. Senator Jeff Merkley, who pressured Stumpf at a banking committee hearing over aggressive sales targeting behind the account fabrications, he reacted to the news with qualified celebration. Stumpf retiring is a good step, but we need a robust criminal investigation of top executives involved in this massive fraud, is what the Oregon Democrat said. As the Boston Globe noted, Stumpf looks far from likely to go home empty-handed, though he did give back $41 million in stock bonuses in recent weeks as a public relations tornado was spiraling all around him.
Yeah.
Stumpf, quote, this is again, according to the Boston Globe, Stumpf, quote, potentially walks away with millions of dollars, including a $20 million pension. As of Wednesday, another $4.3 million in deferred compensation plus stock worth $109 million.
I'm just picturing Stumpf pulling
Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah. How did you know I was going to say that? Just like diving into his gold coins from like DuckTales and just swimming around in his mansion. He's got one room filled with gold coins that he swims in.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I were him, I probably would hide out in my mansion forever too.
Yeah. Must be a generational thing that we thought of the same duck, the same rich duck.
Yeah, I wonder how many Google image searches for Scrooge McDuck diving into the coins have gone up since 2008.
A lot.
I'm willing to wager a lot. But while Stumpf and Wells Fargo still might escape criminal prosecution, as Merkley alluded to, the bank is having trouble escaping the wrath of state bureaucrats. Ohio became the latest state to suspend business with the company for a year. It has been barred from official debt offerings and financial services contracts, is what Governor John Kasich said on Friday. John Kasich. Do you have any fond John Kasich memories you'd like to share?
I just don't know what he was thinking. He passed up an opportunity to be the most powerful vice president in America. Or he didn't, because Trump's not going to get elected.
Well,
so.
He's the adult in the room, and possibly he also figured that the wheels would come off the Trump campaign. So kudos to John Kasich for making that calculation. Anyway, here is
Mike Pence right now wishing John Kasich took the job.
Yeah. But, I mean, again, Mike Pence, he's got this, like, confused puppy look on his face a lot. I'm not sure he's really, like, got the wherewithal to know what's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just a quick hot Pence take. I just slide it in there. Slide in the quick hot Pence takes. Anyway, here's what Kasich said about Wells Fargo. While Wells Fargo only does limited retail banking in Ohio, it does regularly seek state bond business. So I have instructed my administration to seek services from other banks instead. And I will cast my votes against Wells Fargo on the Public Facilities Commission. The company has lost the right to do business with the state of Ohio because its actions have cost it the public's confidence, is what he added. The Senate Banking Committee's ranking member, Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from the state, praised the actions of Kasich. Wells Fargo cheated customers, and until it lays out concrete steps to make things right, it doesn't deserve the state of Ohio's business, is what Sherrod Brown tweeted in reaction to the announcement. And I know that Sherrod Brown tweeted it because it said SB on the tweet.
Oh, yeah.
Finally, if the Justice Department and the SEC decide to move forward with some kind of criminal prosecution of Wells and its execs, the New York Times entered some evidence into the public record this week that could be useful to that end. The paper reported that in 2005, when Stumpf became Wells president, an administrative assistant wrote to the company's HR, human resources, to warn the officials about, quote, sham accounts, forging customer signatures, and sending out unsolicited credit cards. This is in 2005. Anyway, Julie Tishkoff, the Times remarked, was, quote, fired in 2009. At least two of her supervisors were aware of her complaints and ignored them, according to a wrongful termination lawsuit she filed against Wells Fargo in 2011. If that year sounds familiar in all this, it's because in the consent order with the CFPB, the OCC, and City of Los Angeles officials, Wells only admitted to systemic unauthorized account openings between 2011 and 2015. So they there could be something that they knew that they didn't tell federal officials, which I believe is a crime. Last time I checked, the Times also noted that the two supervisors who were aware of Tishkoff's complaints, quote, are now regional presidents responsible for overseeing thousands of workers at hundreds of branches. I'm getting steamed up reading this. All I can say about it, though, is that if the NBA Jam commentator guy, speaking of 90s references, was watching the DOJ and SEC officials investigating this case, I would hope he would say that they're, quote, heating up.
He's heating up.
Yeah,
he's heating up. Good reference. Bad news, though. We spend so much time talking about Stump that we don't have time to get to the listener rant line. That's okay. The rant line is not going anywhere. So what we're going to do is we're going to tease for tomorrow's episode.
Yeah.
A listener rant call that's really good, and we're gonna play it tomorrow since we didn't get to play it today. And maybe we'll have other calls to play tomorrow.
If you call that number, which is 202-684-6108.
Again, that number is 202-684-6108.
Call us up and give us a piece or two of your mind.
Yes, and we'll play it on the air, especially if you own us. That's what we like the most. Anyways, that is going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website, www.districtsentinel.com. Check out all our latest news reports up there. You can also subscribe to this show and have it downloaded every morning into your iPad or into your iPhone or into your dome, wherever the download is.
Get it to the chip that the government planted into your dome piece.
Yes, just go on iTunes and search for District Sentinel Radio and subscribe. Leave us a review, leave a comment. All that stuff is very, very helpful. Stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.